Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
By any measure, Roger Lowenstein is one of this nation's most respected and accomplished journalists on the economy and the world of finance. He reported for more than a decade for the Wall Street Journal, including authoring the journal's Heard on the Street and Intrinsic Value columns. He's currently a regular contributor to publications such as the New York Times Magazine, Smart Money, and Portfolio. In addition to his work as a journalist, Mr. Lowenstein is the author of three best-selling books, including Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist, When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management, and Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble and Its Undoing. Tonight, he speaks to us about his latest book, which is titled When America Aged. And this particular volume features a particularly descriptive and dire subtitle with some regrettably familiar local references. It reads, How Pension Debts Ruined General Motors, Stopped the New York City Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and Loom as the Next Financial Crisis. Please join me now in welcoming Roger Lowenstein.
I want to talk to you about the book, but also about so much else that's going on in the economy. And I came out here 2 years ago with the idea of doing a book just on the problems of the local pension fund, the San Diego Retirement System, SDSERS, as it's known. At that time, two mayors had resigned. The city had lost its credit rating. The city was being investigated for fraud and municipal bond issues. The SEC was all over it. The city attorney, is Mike Aguirre here tonight? He seems to be everywhere. Was at war with just about everybody, and there were cutbacks and layoffs in city agencies, and these austerity conditions were being aggravated by the $25 million or so that was being spent on all these investigations, not to mention the cost of elections to replace all of the officials who were resigning. As you may recall, the city had four elections for mayor in a little less than a little more than 1 year. It's hard for me to believe that they're at it again. Why anybody wants to run for mayor here is a question that maybe some of you locals can answer better than I can. But I spent a good deal of time here back in 05 and 06, and as I did my research, I had the impression of a community that was in many ways distinct, even unique. The guacamole was certainly better, but the political situation was worse. It was a mess. And in particular, the revenue-raising mechanism seemed broken. I saw a community that, although it had very real needs for services like other communities, it had a complete antipathy to any kind of tax or even fees to pay for services, even as I understood it, fees for garbage collection. So that, you know, while in every other town in America you pay to have your garbage collected, that was considered, you know, an affront on individualism here to pay for it. And this disconnect between government expenditures and government revenues, in particular expenditures for public pensions, lay at the causes of San Diego's problems. And that disconnect, and also obviously demographic issues, because retired workers in San Diego, like workers, public workers and other workers everywhere else, were living longer. So it took more to care for them in retirement. But as I got deeper into it, San Diego came to seem not more but less unique in certain ways. And it's true, you have some unique characters. You have a colorful and passionate, pugnacious city attorney. Let's not leave out Donna Frye. And those examples notwithstanding, you have a distinctly conservative political culture with its antipathy to taxes, going back to Ronald Reagan, who used to refer to San Diego, as you may know, as his lucky city, and even before then to former Mayor Wilson, who actually withdrew the city from the Social Security system. You may or may not know that San Diego is only provisionally part of the United States, but that's the way it is. And yes, you've had your share of civic corruption and special interests back scratching and so on, but to put it politely, it's not as if that's unknown on the East Coast. In fact, there are certain politicians in Jersey City and Bridgeport and even New York and Philadelphia who would take affront to that suggestion. So also the demographic issue that I mentioned about San Diego obviously exists everywhere else. What government is not feeling that strain? Certainly the federal government is running a $400 billion deficit all the while this year. All the while, its two major entitlement programs, Medicare and Social Security, are careening into the red. Certainly the federal government then is not immune to what San Diego is feeling, nor the various state and local governments. And as I was out here doing my research on San Diego, the Transport Workers Union of New York called an illegal strike. This was just before Christmas 2005, to shut down the buses and subways in New York over the very same issue of public pensions. Now, this was clearly an issue, an extension of the issues that San Diego was dealing with. There was an activist out here then, I think he's still here, Carl DeMeo, who said at the time that there's a San Diego brewing in every community. And Carl was right. And if framing the problem as just a San Diego issue seemed too narrow, framing it as one of just public or government entitlements didn't seem to take it all in either. And so the book I ended up writing was much broader. While New York at one end of the country and San Diego at the other were embroiled in the particular miseries of public pension debts, there were private corporations all around the country who were straining and in some cases cracking under the same burdens. At GM, and these figures are, you know, they're really figures to ponder, by last year the company was paying benefits to 1.1 million retirees and their spouses. You know, that's a small country, right? While the people, the present workers, the people contributing into these plans numbered 75,000. No city can survive with those type of demographics. No corporation can either. In fact, the Delphi Corporation, which was a spinoff of GM and which still makes many of the parts that GM uses, it filed for bankruptcy that very same autumn of 2005 due to the very same issues of pension debts and health care. And so did Delta Airlines, Northwest Airlines, and many others. So I guess the bad news in that sense is that San Diego cannot claim a special or distinctive franchise after all. This is a problem that cuts across geographic lines and also cuts across institutional lines. We're all going to be dealing with it. As you know, there's only one way to avoid dealing with the challenges of retirement and old age, and we don't recommend that. So, but in all frankness, and I referred earlier to the all the various other current issues, and I suspect that given the number and seriousness of economic problems weighing on the country, many of them quite immediate, and I'm only referring to economic problems. We'll leave out the drug bust and so on for the moment. I suspect that these pension retirement issues may not be the first thing on your mind. And on tour, I've been asked occasionally whether we are suffering from crisis fatigue. And if you don't know what crisis fatigue is, you know, if you can envision a mother of six on a snow day when her kids say that, you know, gleefully, not only are they staying home, but all their friends are coming over too. That's what we mean by crisis fatigue. I assume there's a local equivalent to a snow day. And just to tick off some of these immediate issues, today I saw a gallon of gas priced at $4.49 and a half. The price of food is going through the roof, not to mention health care. The value of the dollar has collapsed, as anyone who's been to Europe can attest. Not only do we have inflation, we have an economic slowdown, probably a recession, seems to be one. Less employment month after month after month. We've lost 250,000 jobs in this country. We're struggling with trade and immigration issues, which is especially familiar in this part of the country. Do we allow the free market to work? Do we let labor markets clear and hire willing and, in most cases, upstanding workers who are coming here for the same reasons that people came here a century ago? Or do we try to build a fence around the lower 48? And if we do, what does that say about our society? I, as a personal note, still remember when President Kennedy said, when I was a boy, vis-a-vis East Berlin, he said, our country may not be perfect, but we never had to build a wall around it. And then there's the big Lollapalooza of economic problems, the one that's getting the headlines in the business pages, the housing and mortgage mess, the subprime credit crunch. 2 million American households facing foreclosure, banks writing off billions of dollars as if it were ordinary business. I don't know what business they're going to have left, and real estate values dropping through the floor. It reminds me a little bit of a book I'm reading, a very good book by a fellow named Tim Egan, about the Dust Bowl back in the 1930s. I just was absorbed in it last night, and these people in Oklahoma and Texas and Kansas, they had to deal with hailstorms that ruined their crops, and then these dust storms, which were literally clouds carrying tons of topsoil, which would fall into their homes and their kitchens and poison their lungs, and they had foreclosures, and the banks that foreclosed on their properties couldn't get any kind of prices for their properties, so the banks failed, so they lost their savings. It was really, as the book is called, the worst hard time, so many of these problems running together. By comparison, we're obviously lucky. We have a lot to be thankful for, and things are obviously not that bad. But even if we aren't starving or as destitute as Americans were in the early and mid-30s, the number and complexity of economic problems does seem reminiscent of that time. And I think it's natural to wonder, where did all of our dark clouds come from, seemingly so suddenly? And are they all related somehow? Are we just suffering a run of bad luck? And at the risk of venturing a guess, I don't think it's entirely coincidental. Some of these problems, we'll see, I think are linked by a common theme, in some cases even by a common set of public policies. I don't mean to say that pensions and the mortgage debacle are exact replicas. In terms of its immediate impact, the 2 million families, possibly more, they're going to lose their homes. The mortgage crisis would seem to be far more serious. Underfunded pensions, you know, they haven't thrown many people out of their homes yet. But in terms of the amount of time that we can expect to be dealing with these issues, I think the ranking is reversed. Bear markets in real estate, and that's essentially what we're dealing with, a down market in real estate, they last a long time, but they don't last forever, and they don't even last a generation. You know, I doubt very much that home prices will have recovered in 2 years' time, but in 10 years' time, and possibly well before that, the housing market and the mortgage market should be well past their bottoms. Not so with retirement. In a decade, that storm, will be entering its worst phase. And if you think about the ultimate cost and also the solutions to these problems, then, sort of surprisingly, the subprime mess is going to be the less costly and also, I think, the easier one to solve by far. One way to think about the mortgage debacle is that some people pay too much for their homes, principally because banks and other financial entities were too willing to lend them too much money. And since the homes were purchased on credit, the pain is being spread between individuals who own these mortgages, the lenders who finance them, the investors, including some supposedly smart Wall Street banks who were dumb enough to invest in pools of these mortgages, and so on. And then let's not forget the credit rating agencies who put AAA ratings on these mortgage pools. In fact, yesterday, the president of Moody's credit rating service resigned, so at least some of the pain is rising to the top. But have you noticed who I left off this list of people suffering the pain? What about the people who sold their homes when others who are now in trouble were overpaying for them? Those people made profits. Presumably they made very big profits. What about the hedge funds and the other speculators who bet that mortgage securities were overvalued? They also made big profits. And if 2 million homes are really foreclosed upon, doesn't that mean that sooner or later, when those homes are sold, some buyers are going to be getting very good values? In fact, as home prices fall, as they must, as they should, a lot of people are going to be getting much cheaper and better values. And that will be to their gain. In almost every case, one loss is offset by someone else's profit. Society as a whole isn't richer, isn't poorer because housing prices go up or down. Well, not completely, because when prices get too bubbly, as they were, developers get induced to build bigger and gaudier homes and overall too many houses relative to what people really wanted. And you know, much in the way that during the late 90s, too much of our resources went into dot-com companies and websites, too much of our resources went into to residential real estate in recent years. Bad prices send the wrong messages about where demand is. But for the most part, it was a zero-sum game with winners and losers. And the antidote, the cure to the slump, is pretty plain. In fact, it's going to happen naturally as long as we don't screw it up. If we let prices fall enough, fall far enough, demand will come back. If we let the housing market return to fair value so that home prices have a smidgen of reasonableness and affordability, even cautious lenders are going to start to make loans again. And as long as that process occurs, meaning as long as we don't try to break the fall and continue to prop up home values, we'll be all right. Now, we may want to help out some of the individual folks who've been hurt, and certainly help those, many of them in particular, I think, who are not native English speakers, who are genuinely taken advantage of by exploitative mortgage brokers. And we should pass some rules to prevent a recurrence. There's no economic basis for issuing a mortgage to someone who doesn't verify their income. I left it at home doesn't work in any other area of the finance, and it really shouldn't in the mortgage business. Nor should mortgages be issued to people with no equity, because those people have no incentive to hang on to their homes. Nor, finally, should teaser rates be allowed. And by teasers, I mean mortgages that start at 4% and then in a couple years flip to 9%. If you want to gamble, we have places that are meant for gambling, like Las Vegas or Wall Street. But people's homes are too important. They're more important, I would think, even than the stock market. They're too much a part of the social fabric to play games with. Mortgage finance cannot be turned into a casino. But I digress. In an economic sense, some people made good trades, some made bad trades, and this happens every day. Some people sold at the top, others overpaid, and they and their creditors, right, they're hurting. And this is producing a sharp downward movement in prices, and eventually, like all market corrections, it will run its course, and then it will begin to rebound. Retirement's much more complicated, and the news isn't as good. There is no natural cure in retirement. It's more complicated, first, because the problem is segmented into several discrete boxes. There are private pension plans, there are public plans like the one in San Diego, there are individual savings such as 401k, and also, obviously, the government retirement plans, Social Security and Medicare. And if we look at Washington First, Social Security and Medicare, one way to think of them is they eat up about 7% of the gross domestic product, seven cents out of every dollar of what, you know, we all produce day in, day out. So if you work, that means, if you work, let's say, 365 days a year, you spend about 25 days each year supporting these two programs. That's on average. Some taxpayers contribute more, some less. You know, some with very sharp accountants maybe get away without contributing anything at all. But for society as a whole, there is no shirking those 25 days. Now, in a generation, those two programs are going to be consuming 13% of the GDP. Call it 46 days labor out of every year. Now, that may seem just or unjust or fair, unfair to you, and you may wonder how come nobody asked you if you want to start working twice as hard for senior citizens as you did before. But, you know, you can sort of hold it because it's a fact, squawk or not. And the proportion is going to be rising after that for a long, long time. So this presents a very real problem because the entire federal budget, everything the government does, highways it builds, the hot lunches it serves, the environmental programs, environmental inspections, the drug laws that it enforces, not even to mention the military, the whole budget's 18% of the GDP. So if you work, and just forgetting for a moment what you pay in state and local taxes, roughly 300 days of your labor every year you keep for yourself, and the other 65 days go to the feds. And right now, of those 65 days, about 40 are left for purposes other than retirement, other than taking care of senior citizens. Well, in 25 years, there'll be only 19 days left for all those other purposes. So essentially what we're saying is we're going to have to cut everything else in half. And a decade or two after that, we're going to have to cut them all down to basically nothing. The federal government will basically become a big transfer operation for Social Security and Medicare and not much else. And Washington is going to start to feel that strain much sooner than that, even. In 2017, which is the last year of the next president, if the next president is a two-term president, in 2017, Social Security will be cash negative for the first time, which means that instead of Social Security lending money to all the other government functions that it has been, all the other functions will going to start having to lend money to Social Security, and they will start to feel the strain. And Medicare, which is in by far worse shape, if nothing is done about Medicare by 2019, this is, you know, 10 years away, it's not some Kubrick movie about the 24th century, it'll be broke. It'll be insolvent in 2019. It won't have enough funds to pay for hospital bills. On the state and local side, and I'll deal with this part more succinctly, it's parallel, but retirement systems such as San Diego's are cumulatively across the country about $1 trillion in the hole. That's the amount by which they're underfunded relative to the pension promises they have made and which they are legally bound to keep. The local pension promises are more binding than Social Security. If we wanted to, we could reduce or even eliminate Social Security promises. I'm not recommending it, but it would be legal by an act of Congress tomorrow. There's no way to get out of a pension debt. And the states and localities have an equivalent liability in retiree health care, which they haven't even begun to count, but add up. But to give you an example I'm familiar with from the other side of the country, New Jersey is $25 billion in the hole in pensions and $58 billion in the red on retiree health care. And that's why Governor Corzine, who must wish he was, you know, back at Goldman Sachs selling bonds, is trying to sell the New Jersey Turnpike, which is something like, you know, if you're California trying to sell Disneyland or the Golden Gate Bridge or something, but it's the closest New Jersey has to an icon. On the private side, corporate pension plans are also hundreds of billions in the hole, and they'll make up a lot of this money. Not every company is going to go broke, but the burden of their doing so is just tremendous. I mentioned the demographic numbers at General Motors earlier, and you know they've finally caught up to their pension liability, but the cost on them of doing so is rather astounding. Over the last 15 years, GM has had to put $55 billion into its pension fund and a like amount into retiree health care, something like $100 billion to retired workers and their families. Meanwhile, the money that they've spent on their own shareholders, who presumably, ostensibly own the company, they've received $12 billion. So the burden of keeping current on benefits has essentially forced a de facto transfer of ownership. The party with the most stake and the biggest claim on their assets and earning power has been the retirees, and this is not a workable model. It's not a workable model in the private sector, and that's why private companies are disbanding their pension plans. They're freezing them, terminating them, and a lot of what's happening is just new companies, you know, they're not starting them. That's why the coverage is dropping. You know, it's sort of like those of us in the journalism business keep wondering where all the subscribers are going, and it finally dawned on some of us that they're not going anywhere. They're just dying, and the new people coming up aren't reading them. And that's happening with pensions. The old pension plans are being terminated. The older retirees are being paid off, and new companies, typified by many in California, aren't starting pension plans. Today, fewer than one in five private sector workers has a defined benefit plan, and that number's shrinking fast. And if you're looking for individual savings, the things that the sort of plans that President Bush talked about when he tried to eviscerate Social Security to stop the gap, forget about it. About half of all families in this country have no meaningful savings at all. And I'll give you the official number from the Fed. The median family has in their retirement plan $31,000. Not $31,000 per year, you know, $31,000 total. And as a nest egg, that's a, you know, it's a nest without the egg. It's not worth talking about. It's a joke. So what we have at every level is this huge future liability and this huge obligation. And unlike with mortgages, unlike with the housing crisis, there is no party on the other side. There's no group of winners who will have savings to match the losses of the you know, people with the liability. I guess you could say the brokers who are hawking retirement condos or the doctors who specialize in replacement knees are winners. But basically, it's a huge net loss for society. It's not as if one group bet on retirement and lost, and there, you know, these group of hedge funds out there that'll be able to bail us all out. Instead, we all stand to lose. And you know, why is that? The reason is pretty plain. We're going to have fewer people working and more people retired, and that ratio used to be 8 to 1. It's now 3 1/3 to 1, and in a generation, it's going to be 2 to 1. So, those of us who are working, you know, we'll have to work harder. If you go back to those days, 25 days won't be enough, 46 days won't be enough. It's going to go up and up and up. We're either going to have to work harder, or we're going to have to devote more of the fruits of what we do work to seniors and less to ourselves, or we're all going to have to consume less. And we've greatly exacerbated this problem by promising a high level of benefits to the retired, in particular the state and local level. There's nothing very egregious or overly generous about Social Security benefits, but in New York State, another example that I feature in the book, retired public servants, and I use that term with some amount of irony, they used to retire at 65, and they would collect a pension, you know, for something like 10 years. It was a sinecure at the tail end of life. Now they start collecting pensions at 50 or 55. Many of them will be retired for 30, even 40 years. Ergo, they're going to be collecting pensions for longer than they were working for, and they're going to be collecting, including Social Security, more money in retirement than they were on the job. You know, this has become something other than just a sinecure at the end of life. This is known as a good deal. And one way to think of this, you know, the next time you visit New York and you ride the subway, it's as if on every car you're paying for two motormen. There's the guy who's driving the train and, you know, the one who's thumbing through retirement brochures, you know, where there's on every fire engine there's two crews, the ones with the hoses putting out the fires, and the guys who are living down in Florida now. And in Massachusetts, there was a case recently of a transportation authority who worked on the known as the Big Dig out there, putting a tunnel under the Charles to get to the airport, and he retired on a pension of $73,000 a year. Okay, he's got to live, but he was 46, and you know, he got a new job with the state of Rhode Island next door for $130,000. Maybe in a few years he'll get a pension there and you know, go work in Connecticut or something. But these arrangements give a whole new meaning to the concept of retirement, and they aggravate, they make the problem a lot worse, especially because as those of you who are familiar with the problem here in San Diego know, pension commitments, as I said before, cannot be reversed. Once granted, they are immutable. So when legislators approve benefits and fail to provide funding, they're really setting a trap for the future, and it's an inescapable trap. At the outset, I said there were shared themes to these issues, various economic issues, and let me just go into one in detail. I start from the premise that we've been behaving badly in each realm. We've been neglecting to provide for future retirees, or we've been legislating the benefits but not funding them, which is a way of not providing. And we've been neglecting to exercise any sort of reasonable supervision over who gets mortgages and loans. So why have we been behaving badly? And maybe you know the term. It's an economist term called moral hazard. To use a sort of a homely example, if a mother on her way to an appointment says to her oldest child, "I left some cookies on the table, please share them with your brother and sister," that's an arrangement that's likely to produce good behavior because, you know, mom will be back before long. The kid knows he or she's going to be in trouble if they disobey and eat them all. And, you know, maybe they'll finger an extra one or two, but the brother and sister will get some. But suppose instead that the mother says something like, "Here are a dozen cookies to take to school. Don't eat more than one for yourself. They aren't healthy. You can share the rest with your friends." No. You know, this is the sort of arrangement that is far less likely to produce a good result if we agree that eating too many cookies is not good, because you know, this kid knows that he faces no punishment or disincentive for overeating, except in the very long term. He's probably going to be more focused on the short term when he gets a very tasty reward. And this is what we call moral hazard. It's an inducement to behaving badly. And moral hazard frequently arises in political environments. Elected officials always face a temptation of overpromising and a bad thing in return for votes, which to them is even tastier than chocolate cookies. You know, how else can we classify the promises of Hillary Clinton and John McCain to erase the gasoline tax this summer? Most of the time in politics, at least, there's some check. You know, mothers coming home before too long. Because if the legislators do promise to build a bridge or to feed the hungry, they're going to have to pay for it. If not immediately, pretty quickly. Food isn't free, concrete isn't free, so they're going to have to raise taxes or cut spending someplace else. But pensions are different. Pensions only have to be paid for in the future, right, when these workers retire. So they are like a free cookie. At least they're free to the officials who approve them, because they're going to be gone. They're going to be retired themselves by the time the day of reckoning comes. They're costly only in the future. And we saw this in a very brazen way in San Diego, and most of you probably know the story, but in brief for those who don't, city officials had a lot of things that they wanted to use the relatively restricted budgetary resources for. They parks and convention center and sports team grants and even buying up unused football tickets so the Chargers wouldn't leave town, and you know, all sorts of good things. And rather than tax for these things, they came up with the idea of shortchanging the pension fund, and they offered what it can only be termed a bribe to the officials of the trustees of the pension fund. What they said was, in return for letting us, the city, off the hook for a few years, for 10 years actually, not having to contribute as much to the fund, we'll raise your benefits, so that the fund now was not just singly but doubly, faced a double increase in its liabilities, first because it wasn't receiving the funding, and second because the ultimate liability, the benefits, were going to be higher. And when the arrangement began to come apart, the officials did what many public officials anywhere will do. They tried like hell to cover it up, and they offered a repeat deal, the same thing. We'll raise the benefits further if you just give us another break from contributing. So now we had the pension underfunding trebly and quadruply increasing. And again, the officials felt, you know, it wasn't going to come home to roost, or so they hoped, until they were gone from the scene. And this is why for so long you had the SEC and the Department of Justice and even the FBI virtually camping out in City Hall. And as I said, this is a brazen example, but the same phenomenon of underfunding pensions, and for the same reason, is common to systems everywhere. So we tend to associate moral hazard of the sort with government. You know, you're familiar maybe with the idea that welfare induces people to be lazy, it's a disincentive to work, or that subsidized flood insurance will lead people to build risky condos by the waterfront. In general, any program that makes it a little less painful to run a risk will induce people to run more of those risks and to behave a little less responsibly. It's only human nature. But moral hazard can also occur in the private sector. Let's look at the housing market. It used to be that a mortgage banker had a very great fear, personally, of issuing a bad loan. Typically, the banker held on to the mortgage for a very long time, maybe for the full 30 years of the loan. And if you didn't pay him back, he personally or his bank took the loss. So mortgages were anything but a free cookie to the banker. They were a cookie associated with a lot of risk in the eyes of the banker issuing the loan. Then along came the wonders of modern finance, new derivative instruments that let people lay off the risk, as bankers like to say, which means that they could transfer it or trade it to other people. In the old days, if First National City lent money to a corporation, they were for sure worried about getting the money back. Not that they didn't make their share of bad loans, but they at least worried about it, and they had reason to worry about it. With derivatives, they can and do transfer the risk to somebody else, and that's why we have corporate loans to leverage companies going bad as well. The banker gets a fee for making the loan, and he doesn't so much worry about the outcome. This is also a moral hazard. In effect, we've turned bankers into the equivalent of welfare cases and politicians, an analogy I know that appreciate. And the process really occurred at its utmost in mortgage finance. These days, the mortgage banker hardly ever keeps a mortgage for 30 years. In fact, 30 days is much closer to the typical case. What does he do after you come in and he gives you a mortgage? Instead of sticking the paper in a drawer, he calls up Merrill Lynch or some such, and you know, he sells it to Merrill, and then Merrill wraps it up with a pool of other mortgages and turns it into a security. Securities are bonds, which are backed by the interest payments on all these mortgages. And then, believe it or not, another banker could be Merrill again, or Morgan, or Bear Stearns. Well, it wouldn't be Bear Stearns now, but some banker takes the bonds from many mortgage pools and wraps them into a pool and creates a new second-order mortgage security called a CDO. And these also are marketed to investors all over the world. And, you know, in theory, the player at each stage of the chain, the homeowner, the banker, the investment banker, the credit agency, the second layer of investment banker, and the ultimate investor, the guy who buys the CDOs, in theory, each one of these are assessing the risk along down the chain. But that chain gets pretty long, and it gets pretty distant from the ultimate source of the risk, which is the mortgages. The CDOs might be held by some insurance company in the Netherlands, and you know, what are they going to know about a bunch of mortgages in Riverside? Chances are nothing. So the perception of risk gets diluted at each stage until finally it disappears. And that's how we get a mortgage crisis, bankers and investment bankers behaving as though they don't pay a penalty for writing bad loans. And also, I would submit, that's how we get a pension funding crisis. Legislators, as well as union executives and CEOs, who realize that they personally don't pay a penalty for agreeing to high benefits, even benefits that are beyond the ability of sponsors to fund. In the short term, no problem. In the long term, somebody else's, their successor's problem. Is there even a deeper connection between these issues? If you think of America in the recent decade as over-mortgaged, the very term should connote, just by the definition of that phrase, overborrowed. People who borrow to excess, what they're really doing is spending to excess. They're consuming to excess. In housing, we saw this very graphically because what people did with their home equity loans in many cases was they tapped them to buy, televisions or stereo systems or iPods or whatever. But even if they were just borrowing for the real estate itself, they were clearly borrowing too much. They were consuming too much. And our real estate behavior and our real estate crisis is a very large symptom of that national disease, which is our propensity to borrow or overborrow, or, and this means the same thing, of our failure to save. In recent years, the average American has a negative saving rate, which means that he or she has been saving, consuming more than they earn. And the federal government, as I mentioned, has been no better, because it's been cutting taxes and raising spending, and this year we'll have that $400 billion deficit, and that is only going to grow in the years on out. So if mortgages are a large symptom of the problem of non-saving, where and when will the effects of this problem be felt most gravely? Suppose, for example, that the country were just one family, and it was a family that was rapidly aging and in which we could say some of the breadwinners, grandma and grandpa, were about to retire. That family, if it were prudent, they would be storing money away. They'd be saving. If they consumed everything that they earn in advance of those breadwinners retiring, we would say they'd be foolhardy. And if they were going deeper into debt at that time, we'd say they were reckless. And that's exactly what the country is doing. Just as the baby boomers are getting set to pack up their electronic toys and their Dylan records for Florida, we are going deeper into hock. And the specific options and remedies for each retiree, each company, each public pension fund, they vary, and we can get into those if you want in the Q&A. But as a society, there's only one option, and that's to save more or to consume less or to do some of each. We can mitigate the effects a little bit by taking in more workers, and those more workers are people who we would call immigrants. And by the way, that would also take some of the heat off the housing crisis, because with boomers retiring, we're going to need more working-age families to absorb what is now a pretty big oversupply of family-sized homes. But, you know, short of annexing, you know, the three or four northernmost states of Mexico, immigrants aren't going to alone do the trick. We're going to have to start saving to make up for the deficit of people who are working, to make up for the proportional deficit, the reduction in working age people. We're going to have to reduce our consumption. And the housing borrowing binge has only made it worse. And the so-called remedy to the housing crisis of lower interest rates, which is the remedy, of course, that the Federal Reserve has been pushing so aggressively, I would say is also making it worse. We act as though lower interest rates are always and everywhere better. They're obviously an inducement to borrow, and at some point, you know, one might begin to ask, have we borrowed enough? But even beyond that, every time the Fed cuts rates, it's sending an implicit signal to every American. What it's saying is, spend everything you have, don't save, because the return on savings is going down. We're lowering the rates, and the money's not going to be worth anything anyway. So start spending. And this is exactly why the dollar is depreciating. It's snapped our ability to borrow from overseas. Foreigners don't want the dollar. It's why there's particularly a run or inflation in goods that are priced overseas, oil and food and commodities and so on. We've been living beyond our means for a long time in two ways. We've been borrowing from other countries and also borrowing from future generations. And the world, the future generations can't speak, but the rest of the world can, and it's saying that our dollars aren't worth what they used to be, and so we're going to need more of them to buy what the world is selling. Some of these trends, I think, are irreversible, you know, for a good while. America had, a high-tech revolution to itself almost in the 90s, and now the world is catching up to us, and we're competing with people who are just as skilled as we are, but they live in countries that are poor and they'll work for salaries that are a lot lower. And, you know, that has got to mean that the economic value of our labor, of what we produce, relative to the rest of the world, is going to decrease. And we can insulate our workers and retirees nationally, meaning we can subsidize them, subsidize their benefits at a governmental level, but that's going to mean, it has to mean, that we will have to pay for it and therefore tax for it. And when you tax, it means that somebody, it's just a reallocation. It's going to mean that somebody's going to be working more days in those 25 or 46 days. Yeah. Ultimately, what it means is that the era when America can borrow on the cheap to defray its own present needs and its legislated future consumption, that era is coming to an end. You know, I think our houses are going to remain standing. I don't see any hailstorms or dust clouds of the sort in the 30s, although I wonder if in a decade we'll be living in on average in homes that are as large as the ones we see today. And I think in closing I would say I think we'll work our way out of the mortgage mess and out of the credit crunch and the recession. But I would predict that we'll be struggling with the issue of having fewer workers per retirees and of declining productivity relative to other less wealthy and younger nations, possibly for a very long time. And I think that the falling dollar, our growing budget deficits, and the distress of places like San Diego that look for easy outs, they're only the first and the early warning signs. And I think there'll be many more to come. And thank you very much. Please comment on population growth would not be a good solution. It would just postpone the pension problem and worsen it eventually. Population growth is a solution to the problems of not having enough young people, but it sometimes solutions create new problems, and in terms of resource usage, energy shortages and things like that. You can see in many parts of the world, we don't necessarily want to have more population. What reallocating population by immigration is one solution, and I think one thing that may happen in the future, willingly or otherwise, it's a form of population growth, or it's a form of reallocating population, we may change the definition of what it means to be working age. You know, we may see more of a demand for people who are 65 or 70 to remain in the workforce at the same time as we have less ability to, pay benefits. And that may be one way that the balance gets shifted. Well, here's a question about a mutual fund I'm associated with, which I think we're going to put that in the censorship rubric since it's not really germane to anything we're talking about. Roger, Ben Bernanke and other policymakers clearly see the fiscal crisis approaching rapidly and recognize the insurmountable mismatch between government revenues and government liabilities. That being said, Bernanke and other central bankers talk about containing inflation, but is there a way to avoid inflationary pressures resulting from budget deficits that are in our future? Well, there's a lot in that question. First case, the question assumes that inflation comes from deficits. The best guess of economists is that inflation comes from the Federal Reserve printing too much money. It doesn't really matter since we have both right now. We have the Fed expanding the money supply at a very rapid. In fact, I saw a chart. It looks like it's the quickest growth in the drop in interest rates that we've ever had, and we have budget deficits. So I think it raises the question of moral hazard with the Fed itself, and there's a lot of you hear this a lot when they do things like helping to bail out Bear Stearns or helping to ease the sale of a bankrupt Bear Stearns or lending money, taking the mortgage securities off the hands of investment banks and easing their credit situation. And there is, the fear obviously is that people, knowing that the Fed is standing behind them, will take more risks. I think that's true, but I think it's true only in a limited sense because, nobody at Bear Stearns does what they did or gets in the shape they did because they think the Fed will ease the transition because they suffered a pretty humbling and a pretty painful loss. I think there's where the risk of moral hazard comes in with the Fed is right with this question's asking about, is the risk of inflation. There's always, Bernanke, I interviewed once, and he said nobody likes to raise interest rates. And I think he was speaking as himself personally as a central banker. And, I think central bankers, like everyone else, are responsive to public and Wall Street pressures. There's a tremendous amount of pressure on them to lower rates. These days, there's something called the Fed futures, Fed funds futures, which is it's sort of a fever line of where Wall Street is betting day in, day out, hour by hour, minute by minute, where the Fed funds rate will go. So Bernanke and his colleagues can see exactly what Wall Street is expecting, and they know, for instance, if Wall Street's expecting lower rates and they come out with higher rates, everyone's going to be surprised. Wall Street doesn't like surprises. The market's going to tank, and he's going to have a bad night. So he's always dealing with sort of a short-term difficulties in one hand, where if he raises rates, or long-term difficulty, long-term inflation risks of lowering rates, and I think there's moral hazard there too. That the Fed is susceptible to. To wanting to please people as well, and I think we've seen some of that. Will any governmental regulator, such as the SEC, ever be granted real authority to compel the investment banking industry to fully disclose the true value of their Level 2 and Level 3 assets, assuming that is that the investment banks knew the real value of their assets? This is a really good question. One thing that the Fed has done is big change. The Fed has always loaned money to commercial banks, but in this latest round, they said that they would extend credit to investment banks who were never, in the federal safety net before. And there's always been an explicit trade-off. If you're a commercial bank, and of course you have the ultimate protection that the government will bail out your depositors if you fail. The penalty, the price for that is that there's a great amount of disclosure of where your assets are, and the government penalizes you for for putting your assets in risky types of securities or vehicles, so that you know you have to have a certain amount of assets in the, you know, each cashier can't lend out everything that you deposit with them. They have to keep some there in the drawer, and if they're lending to Treasury securities, they don't have to keep as much. If they're lending to CDOs, they have to keep more. But there are no rules like that for investment banks, and yet you know, we seem to be offering them government protection. So if this is really sort of policy or future practice or the future expectation, then it would seem that we would have to or should have more scrutiny of investment banks. And the tough part of it is no one's really figured out how to value a lot of these assets. The balance sheet rules were all defined, were all designed for what's on your balance sheet, for bonds, for loans, you know, for real assets. Most of the trouble with that investment banks get into these days is with derivatives. And our disclosure of these instruments and even our ability to rate to value them is you know, way behind the bankers' creativity in concocting them up. So it's a real problem. In France, workers are taxed at 50% of their salary. Why don't Americans just pay more taxes? Ask Donna Fry. You know, she. I think I have these numbers right. In when she ran for mayor in, I can't remember now whether it was 04 or 05, the runoff, but it was 05 in the runoff. She proposed that if and only if the new pension liabilities were made to stick, there'd be a 0.5% increase in the hotel tax. And you know, she was run out of town as a taxer and a spender. I mean, I can just say to the questioner, in case you haven't noticed, taxes aren't very popular in this country. And that's, you know, we've always sort of been schizophrenic, I think, about benefits. We want them, but you know, we don't want to pay for them. And I don't think we got to go back to 50% for middle Americans, but there's a long way between us and France. What are the solutions to the aging problem? Well, I can think of one. I mean, you know, there's no one single bullet. I mean, I've talked a lot about saving. Hillary Clinton, you'll remember Hillary Clinton, I'm sure. She has an interesting plank, which is to encourage private saving by having a sort of a national 401k, so that particularly with people who don't have 401ks, but everybody up to a certain income level, for every dollar they put in, the government would match $500 to $1,000 a year. And it may not sound like a lot, but if you go back to that figure of the median family having $31,000, you know, you can see that if they were putting aside $2,000, $3,000 a year, you know, it would make a difference. Now, that has to be paid for. Obama has another wrinkle, which is kind of interesting. Lots of people have 401ks, but or they have 401ks available to them, even matching programs, and they don't take advantage of them, which is really just like throwing money away when the employer is matching. So what Obama would do is, right now, if you have a 401k, you have to check off that you want to participate. And that, you know, that defeats some people. But so what he would do is change the system so that you're automatically enrolled, and then you just have to check the box that says "count me out." And you know, it sounds surprising that would make such a difference, but it probably would. It would lead to more saving. I mean, I think also the withering away of the private pension network has pretty big implications for Social Security because. You know, that's all that's going to be left for a lot of people, and you know, there it's clear. We just have to increase the payroll tax. You can raise the cap so that wealthy people pay more. You can raise it across the board. You know, you can allocate it however you do. But I think that's going to happen. At the state level, the states are really in trouble. A lot of them, and that was sort of masked during the years of the economic growth. But now. You know, it's obviously not with a real estate collapse. It's not masked anymore, and you know, one solution would be a law similar to what corporations theoretically live under, which the ERISA law, something that actually Mike Aguirre has proposed, that if you legislate a benefit, you know, legally you have to put the money away that year, every dollar of it, and so that you'd at least have, in some cases, you'd get higher benefits, probably not many. In some cases, you'd get lower benefits, but you'd have legislators making sort of honest decisions about whether they wanted more taxes, more benefits, or less of each, not more of one and less of the other. You know, there aren't, this is sort of a diffuse answer, because there's not just going to be one answer. It's a complicated problem in a lot of those separate little boxes, and you know, there is no one bullet. Yeah, this is a good question, actually. In the 1950s and 60s, the top marginal rate was 90%. Now it's 35%. Please comment. Phew. You know, thank God, right? That's a very good comment, because the Republican platform on taxes, which is basically never, ever, ever, I think really misses an important point that's brought out by this question. When Reagan put through his really big tax cuts, the marginal rate then was 70%. It was a 90, but it was still pretty high. And I think it really had a very big motivating influence on people. And I think it did have something to do with, you know, with the resurgence of economic growth in the 80s and the 90s too. But just tinkering with, and everything since then has just been tinkering, you know, at the edges. Clinton raised it to 39.6%, the marginal rate, and Bush took it down to 35%. And the notion that someone's going to work harder or less hard because they keep, you know, 65% of the $20 million they make, or 61% of the $20 million they make, is ludicrous. Those very big shifts make a big difference. And if we were going to, you know, if somebody was proposing to raise the take back to 90%, you know, I think it'd be a mistake. But if the government's running a deficit, then I think it's really silly to build in those tax cuts as McCain wants to do. Worst hard times, a story of persistence. What do you think of the persistence of the future American populace? Yeah, I'll go with that. I think we're persistent folk and we'll work our way through. Doesn't municipal bankruptcy force renegotiation of pension benefits? No, they stay. They wouldn't. I mean, you'd have to sell off. You know, I guess this is a state institution, not a municipal one. But you'd be, you know, you'd be digging up the last street and selling off the pipes underneath before you could renege on pensions. Otherwise, I guess you know, there'd be a lot more cities that went that route. So thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.